Welcome to The Social Science of War, a podcast for the land warfare professional. My name is Kyle Atwell. I'm an Army officer currently instructing international affairs at the Social Sciences Department at West Point. And in today's episode, I speak with a scholar and a senior command sergeant major about how Army service impacts a soldier's earning potential, how the Army is responding to its current recruiting challenges, and other talent management issues. Our first guest is Lieutenant Colonel Kyle Greenberg. He's an economist within the West Point Department of Social Sciences and is also the Director of Long-Term Research for the Army's Office of Economic and Manpower Analysis, which conducts empirical analysis for senior Army leaders on personnel issues. Today's conversation focuses on an article he co-authored in Harvard's Quarterly Journal of Economics, which examines how service in the all-volunteer force impacts the long-term income ability of enlisted soldiers. Our second guest is Command Sergeant Major Faith Alexander. She is the Senior Enlisted Advisor at the Army Enterprise Marketing Office, which supports the Army's recruiting efforts. She began her distinguished career in 1996 as a geospatial engineer and has led countless soldiers over the past 25 years from the squad level to most recently being the Command Sergeant Major for Army University, and before that, the Garrison Sergeant Major at Fort Leonard Wood. The Social Science of War podcast is brought to you by the Department of Social Sciences at West Point. Our goal is to bring together experienced soldiers and scholars to better understand land warfare, the Army, and national security strategy. We hope you enjoy today's conversation with Kyle and Alex. Command Sergeant Major Faith Alexander, or Alex for short, and Lieutenant Colonel Kyle Greenberg, welcome to Season 1, Episode 3 of the Social Science of War podcast. I'm really looking forward to what promises to be an extremely interesting conversation.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Today, we're going to talk about some talent management issues within the Army. Before we get into the weeds, though, I'd like to get a little context on the two organizations you each work for, particularly given they both play an important role in the Army's broader personnel and talent management organization. Alex, you work with the Army Enterprise Marketing Office based in Chicago, and Kyle, you work with the Army's Office of Economic and Manpower Analysis nestled right here in the basement of the Department of Social Sciences at West Point. These two organizations play important roles in the Army's talent management, which I think it's important for the audience to understand. So starting with Kyle, what does the Office of Economic and Manpower Analysis do, and how did you find yourself working there?
OEMA is an Army research agency under the Army G1 that's located at West Point rather than the Pentagon. We conduct program evaluations, policy analysis, and academic research to improve the Army's existing people programs and to help deliver new ones. My role is currently to oversee our long-term academic research efforts. And this is an academy professor position. So everyone who works in OEMA, at least the military faculty, they come through West Point, and that's how I ended up working at OEMA, first by being an assistant professor at West Point. But my role as the long-term research director is to help the office publish articles in peer-reviewed journals that are focusing on topics that are important to the Army, but also to the broader field of economics. And this setup works really well because it allows our research team to explore questions that are typically not the close-range targets that maybe the Army staff is focused on, but that are still very important for the Army to develop sound policies.
And just for context, what are some of the biggest challenges or topics that both the Army and the Department is focusing on right now in personnel issues?
So in personnel issues, I mean, the recruiting challenge is a huge issue at the moment. And I think that's taking up a lot of bandwidth for the Army and the Army staff, and for good reason.
Yeah, just to jump in real quick, by recruiting challenge, you're referencing the fact that the Army's facing shortfalls in its recruiting numbers, something around, I think, 15,000 recruits short last year. And some media reports that this is the biggest recruiting shortfall since the start of the all-volunteer force back in 1973. This is definitely a topic we're going to jump into today. But before we do so, what other challenges is OEMA focused on right now?
You know, besides recruiting and retention, certainly there's a lot of work around officer like selection problems. Like, so not necessarily problems, but when you think of the battalion commander assessment program or the commander's assessment program, those are some big initiatives that started with the Talent Management Task Force with assistance from OEMA. Also, a lot of efforts to look at like talent-based branching, as well as the officer and enlisted assignment process through markets like AIM-2, for example. And then right now, although this is not something that OEMA is directly focused on, but we do offer some assistance at times. The transition to IPSE is also taking a lot of focus from the personnel director, not necessarily in a bad way, but as we transition to this new platform, it is taking a lot of resources to make sure that this transition goes smoothly.
And Alex, can you briefly describe what the Army Enterprise Marketing Office is and your path to how you got there?
It's pretty much the marketing branch of the Army. What enticed the prospect, whether that be a officer enlisted or in whatever category, to come into the Army, civilians, National Guard, reservist, you name it. What entices individuals to come into the Army? So I'm kind of the marketing arm of a piece of it. I think you can call recruiting command a sales piece of that. And so my job is to entice them to the storefront.
There's actually quite a big connection between OEMA and AMO. OEMA is actually the proponency for AMO. We also have three AMO officers who are co-located at OEMA. And a lot of the analysis that OEMA does related to recruiting is hand in hand with some of the analysis that AMO is doing, whether that's analyzing recruiter incentive pilots or analyzing different marketing strategies, or just helping the Army think through, okay, here are some of the reasons why we might be having this recruiting challenge. A lot of that is work that both OEMA and AMO are doing together.
Let's turn to your co-authored article, Kyle, which was recently published in Harvard's Quarterly Journal of Economics, and it's titled Army Service in the All-Volunteer Era. It's important to emphasize that this is an independent piece of scholarship, which you conducted as an economist and not in any way an official Army report. However, it's incredibly interesting for Army professionals for a couple reasons. First, as a member of the Army, for me personally, the statistical analysis you conduct on a whole range of issues is just incredibly fascinating. You know, even apart from your main finding, you provide statistics on things like the average retention rates for various groups of soldiers, whether certain ethnic groups are more likely to serve in combat arms or support branches, whether soldiers are more likely to get college degrees than their civilian counterparts based on benefits like the GI Bill and tuition assistance. It's just full of interesting statistics like these. However, it's also important because your findings have implications for Army organizational policies in the areas of recruiting, retention, benefits programs, and other areas, and frankly, broader implications for an American society which continues to struggle with pay gaps and social mobility challenges outside of the military. To get us started, can you provide a brief overview of what motivated this research project? What was the puzzle or motivating question that you were seeking to address?
As you mentioned, the Army did not commission this research. They did not call me up and ask me to write this paper. The genesis of this project was several discussions with my graduate school advisor, Dr. Josh Angris at MIT, almost 10 years ago. And Josh has done a lot of work where he's used the Vietnam era draft lottery to study the causal effects of compulsory military service. And he urged me to look for ways to identify the causal effects of more recent voluntary military service. And so I spent a lot of my time in graduate school collecting data for this project and learning the institutional details required to identify a causal effect. But then the project stalled for a few years because even though I had all the Army data or the military data, I didn't have access to earnings data. And it was actually when I was working at Human Resources Command, I think it was 2018, that I got a call from my West Point colleagues, Rich Patterson, who is now at BYU, but was at West Point at the time, and Matt Gudgeon. And they told me that they were very interested in joining this project. And they also had two connections at the Department of Treasury, Corbin Miller and Adam Eisen, who could help us obtain earnings data. And so that's how this team formed, and we've really worked well together since then.
So your project seeks to understand how enlisted service in the military, in the Army, impacts an individual's long-term income and social mobility. And you specifically link data for soldiers who enlisted in the Army from 1990 to 2011 with various social outcomes later in life, such as their annual income, home ownership, marital status, and other factors. Given your question of how Army service impacts income mobility for enlisted soldiers, what are your central findings?
We find that voluntary Army service has significant earnings and related benefits. And this is particularly true for Black applicants who enlist. Both Black and white applicants benefit from Army service in the short run, mainly because the military pays very well relative to comparable civilian jobs. But when we look at outcomes 11 to 19 years after application, after most enlistees have left the service, Black veterans experience annual earnings gains of $5,500 to $15,000 per year. White veterans do not see significant changes in their earnings. And I also mentioned that Black veterans also experience substantial increases in homeownership and marriage. And so that's consistent with this idea that the Army is improving their long-run earnings and prospects, as well as their long-run prospects related to similar outcomes, such as homeownership and marriage. But I'll add one more thing to this. The Army is improving also educational attainment for both Black and white veterans. I think there's some concerns that a lot of people might be not joining the Army because they're worried that, well, if I join the Army, I'm not going to go to school. What we actually find is that that's actually not true. Joining the Army increases the likelihood that you attend college. You might be delaying college by 1 or 2 years, but through things like the GI Bill and tuition assistance, that's greatly increasing college completion down the road.
So that's for everybody. And anybody who joins the Army is more likely to get a college degree because of these benefits programs the Army provides to pay for college?
On average, certainly more likely to start college. And yes, in most cases, also more likely to obtain a college degree down the road.
Well, this is significant because it suggests that the Army might be a vehicle for upward social mobility for everybody, but particularly for minority groups.
When we talk about, you know, when we talk about racial demographics, I think it's very important for us to understand also that how those individuals came into the Army, their economic status when they came in versus their economic status when they left. Okay, so I will use myself as an example. Okay, very impoverished environment, low socioeconomic status, came in, of course, and able to build from that. So of course, that's a significant increase from not making any money, right? But let's say if, you know, across those racial lines, the typical normal white American comes into the Army. I'm not saying that all of those individuals, you know, have a better socioeconomic status, but I think if you looked at the actual numbers, you would see that a larger number of those individuals have a better economic status than a Private Alexander did. And so I think it's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit leading to say that, yes, the Army improved. Yes, the Army did improve quality of life. And okay, African-Americans or Black Americans saw a significant increase. But yeah, of course, you're going to see a significant increase if I made next to nothing. And of course, this other person that had probably a higher socioeconomic status prior to joining the Army by family virtue, you know, by family or whatever the case. Yeah, they probably didn't see much of a significant difference because they already met the threshold to meet a certain socioeconomic status.
So when we looked at this and we saw these differences by race, the very first question we had was, well, is this something about differences by race, or is this about differences in economic status prior to enlisting in the military? And what we actually find is that if we look at, say, white applicants from lower socioeconomic status, yes, it is true that the Army improves their earnings more than white applicants from a higher socioeconomic status. But even when we account for that socioeconomic status, we still find these substantial differences by race. There is something about these differences in effects that are particular to race that are not explained by differences in socioeconomic status. And we think this actually relates to sort of a broader economics research that has nothing to do with the Army, just finding a lot of evidence that for whatever reason, Black Americans face a lot of disadvantages relative to white Americans. Even when we compare Black Americans from the exact same background or very similar backgrounds to white Americans, whether those are high socioeconomic backgrounds or low socioeconomic backgrounds.
So just to be clear, so you guys were able to essentially control for this, where you'd say, hey, you know, let's put a group of people who are Black and white, and they essentially did come from the same, you know, impoverished background, or they had single parents or whatever. Even then, you see that a Black enlisted member ends up better off 19 years down the road than a white service member did.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So using observable measures of socioeconomic status, that does not account for the differences that we find by race.
So what data challenges did you need to overcome to have confidence in your results?
The big challenge with estimating the causal effect of voluntary Army service is that if you just compare service members to non-service members, that comparison is unlikely to account for important differences in underlying earnings potential. You know, the Army is a selective organization. Many of the people that we select into the Army might have higher earnings down the road for reasons that have nothing to do with their Army service.
Okay, so you're saying that because there's already less than 25% of the population that even qualifies to join the Army, either for, you know, physical reasons or because they don't get a high enough score on an aptitude test like the ASVAB, it might be hard to compare the Army population with the control population of everybody who has not joined the Army. So how did you overcome this challenge within your research design?
So to overcome these selection problems, we use the Army's Armed Forces Qualification Test, or AFQT, eligibility thresholds. Now, the AFQT, it's a composite from four of the ASVAB tests that Army applicants take when they're applying to enlist. The Army will rarely accept applicants who score lower than a 31, and will also restrict many enlistment bonuses only to applicants who score at least an AFQT score of 50 or higher. And just to give you an idea, these numbers are percentiles. So if you get an AFQT score of 31, it's like saying you are scoring better than 31% of a nationally representative sample of 17 to 22-year-olds who took the same test. But as a result of these eligibility thresholds at both 31 and 50, applicants who barely reach one of those thresholds when they take the AFQT are significantly more likely to serve than those who barely miss the threshold. Except for their propensity to enlist, these groups are otherwise indistinguishable from each other. And so that's how we're able to identify causal effect.
Okay, so we have discussed that joining the Army increases the average income earnings for all enlisted soldiers and Black soldiers at higher rates than white soldiers over time. In the paper, you identify some interesting statistics that might explain why this is the case, and I'd like to get into all of them, but let's start with one interesting point. You find that statistically, white service members are overrepresented in combat arms MOSs like the infantry, while Black service members are overrepresented in support branches like quartermaster, which might provide occupational skills relevant to the civilian market.
I think I would be interested in understanding this piece. I mean, okay, so I'm just going to use myself as an example, okay? So my parents, I don't know about every African-American or Black parent out there, but my parents, when I joined the military, like, they heavily emphasized the trade, right? And so I guess my question would be, those Black or African-Americans that did significantly better due to whatever the case, I'll be interested in knowing, hey, did they have a trade? Did they have an MOS or a military occupational specialty that directly allowed them to go into another area that provided them with that comfort, so to speak, versus not having a trade, right? I'm not saying I don't appreciate our combat arms, but sometimes it doesn't translate well into the civilian sector. Whereas a geospatial engineer, I mean, I can get out right now and be a geospatial engineer and have a pretty solid, you know, comfort zone. And so I would be interested in how many of those, you know, Black or African-American enlisted soldiers actually got an MOS that was related or closely related to a trade. That would be interesting to understand.
Are you saying my infantry background won't get me a job when I get out of the Army?
I'm not saying that.
Well, no, that's a great question because it really gets at this broader question of like, okay, if you're finding differences by race and it's not explained by differences in socioeconomic status, what are the mechanisms that are driving these differential effects? And one potential explanation is that it is true that Black Americans who enlist are more likely to join service support or combat support jobs relative to white Americans who are more likely to join combat jobs like infantry and armor. What we surmise, and it is a bit of a best guess on this one, it doesn't appear that serving as, say, you know, a logistics specialty leads to better earnings than serving as an 11 Bravo in infantry man or serving in the like in a cavalry unit. There's a major caveat to this, though, which is that these are all just based on summary statistics, and we can't say with certainty that, you know, the causal effect of enlisting as an infantry soldier has this effect on your earnings relative to enlisting as an intelligence soldier. This is actually it's a very interesting question, and it's some research that others in OIMA are working on. Matt Gudgeon, one of my co-authors in this paper, is working on it with Aaron Phipps and Luke Gallagher, who are working with Jesse Brune at Brown to see if there's a way that they can tease out the causal effect of enlisting in one occupation versus another. But at the moment, we don't think that differences in occupations are explaining our differential effects by race.
So the numbers show that white service members choose to serve in combat arms at a higher rate than black service members. Admittedly, this is a difficult topic to discuss because it can be sensitive. And nonetheless, I know this is an issue the Army is looking into as it seeks diversity overall and across branches. Do we have any intuitions or evidence for why white service members tend to choose combat arms while black service members tend to choose service support branches?
I've thought about this question quite a bit, but more in the context of cadet branching, because a lot of the work I do in OWIMA relates to the process by which West Point and ROTC cadets receive their branches. And yes, over the past at least 20, if not 30 years, it's quite obvious that infantry and armor are much more popular among white cadets than they are among black cadets. And so there's a big question about why this is. And the two potential reasons that I think are really important and worth emphasizing are, you know, one is I've heard that when black people join the Army, maybe they're more likely to want to enlist in an occupation that's going to help them develop a trait or specific skill later on in life. And another potential reason is that they're doing what their mentors and their parents or their family members who previously served were doing. And because of those historical reasons that the Army did not allow black service members, you know, in the 1940s and earlier, to enlist in combat occupations, that would drive persistent differences in the composition of who is enlisting in combat occupations versus non-combat occupations. Now, those are two potential reasons. I will say I have not seen great data or exceptional surveys to back this up, but those are reasons that I've heard from almost every conversation I have with people about these issues in the context of cadet branching, as well as in enlisted personnel and how they select their MOSs.
Kyle, you started by outlining that the Army can help close pay gaps and social inequality, which supports arguments which have been made by some senior leaders, perhaps most prominently General Colin Powell, who stated, and I'm quoting here, "The military has given African Americans more equal opportunity than any other institution in American society." It seems like this has pretty broad implications for the military and perhaps for American society as a whole.
When we think about those implications of our study for society at large, our findings suggest that, you know, as Colin Powell suggested, the Army can be an important institution for improving income mobility in America. And this also, in many ways, speaks to the relative disadvantages of the next best option for young Black Americans in particular. There's a lot of recent economics research that suggests that economic opportunities continue to be starkly different by race. By some estimates, I think I've seen that the typical Black American man earns only about half as much as a typical white American man. And the typical Black American woman only earns about 75% as much as a typical white American woman. And those are huge gaps. And they also extend to the individuals that we see applying to service. In our sample, for example, we find that even when we're looking at applicants who have identical test scores, Black service members would have earned about $10,000 less per year than white service members if both the Black and white service members had not enlisted. And that's a huge pay gap. So what our findings suggest is that serving in the Army leads to a large enough increase for Black veterans in particular that it's enough to close that $10,000 gap. And so now I think the challenge for researchers is to say, okay, what aspects of the Army experience or different aspects of potential Army experiences are helping to close this gap? What is it about the Army that is helping Black Americans in particular? And as we learn more about those potential mechanisms, how can we apply some of those lessons to other public policies that aim to improve economic mobility for all disadvantaged groups throughout the country and not just focusing specifically on the Army?
And so that is the next question. Why is this happening? What are the underlying mechanisms that explain why the Army offers more equal opportunity than other institutions in American society?
When you think about like this question of, okay, we find differential effects of service for Black and white Americans, particularly in the long run, why might this be occurring? We did briefly talk that one explanation could be the different occupations that Black and white enlisted soldiers tend to choose. We don't think that's driving this, but you know, it's still a possibility. When we think more about those mechanisms, though, there are a few things that we can say. So first, we can say that Black service members tend to stay in the Army longer than white service members. And some of this does reflect the lack of outside options for Black Americans in the civilian labor force. But by virtue of the fact that Black service members tend to serve longer, the Army does pay well. And so this contributes to some of the differences in earnings we find by race. But it's also important to say that the post-service job quality appears to be an even more important factor than differences in Army retention. And in particular, what we find is that Army service increases the probability that Black veterans find employment in well-paying, typically public sector jobs after they leave the military. Not always public sector, but just in general, better paying jobs that are oftentimes more likely to be in the public sector. And we also find that Black veterans tend to enter higher paying industries after they leave the service. So why is the Army improving this post-service job quality of Black service members more than white service members? That's a bit of an open question. Black and white service members, they tend to deploy to combat zones at roughly similar rates. So we don't think that deployment is sort of the contributing factor here. Black and white service members tend to use the GI Bill at similar rates. And they also appear to receive disability compensation at similar rates. So we don't think that the GI Bill or differential receipt of veterans' disability are driving the differences that we find. As I mentioned before, we don't think that this is a story about different occupations. Largely, that leaves a lot of unanswered questions. Like, we can't say for sure why Army service tends to expand the employment opportunities for Black veterans more than white veterans. But some of the hypotheses we thought about and that we think that would be good to explore in future research include things like, it's possible that the Army is particularly good at enhancing networks for Black veterans more so than white veterans. The Army could be increasing human capital in ways that are not captured in education levels, or the Army could be providing a credentialing effect that diminishes the effects of racial discrimination that there's a lot of evidence for in the civilian labor market. And so ultimately, we need more research to pin these down, but those are some potential reasons that we think might be driving these differences.
Okay, so I'd like to close out the conversation with a discussion on what the implications of Kyle's recent research are, and your extensive experience in the Army, Alex, including your time right now at the Army Enterprise Marketing Office for Army Talent Management Policies at Large. Kyle, we can start with you. What are the biggest implications of your research for the Army as an organization?
From the Army's perspective, you know, our study does suggest that that serving in the Army is a good value proposition. You know, if a 20-year-old walks into a recruiter's office today, the recruiter can tell her, you know, if you decide to enlist, your earnings of the next 20 years are likely going to exceed what you would earn if you decided not to enlist. And this is particularly true for Black Americans, but it's also true that serving in the Army increases the average cumulative earnings of white Americans as well. And so I think going forward, the Army's challenge, as well as the VA's challenge, is to figure out how the Department of Defense can continue to retain this advantage amid a changing labor market. And I will briefly go back to something that Alex mentioned earlier about, it is fair to say that, look, individuals who apply to the Army between 1990 and 2011, those are people our age, you know, that they might not be the same as people who are applying today. And that is a fair point. What I will say is that Army pay, if anything, has gotten better over the past 10 years. And also, when we look at changing patterns in retention or even enlistment, yes, those patterns do change a little bit from year to year, but they haven't changed so much to make me think that we would find wildly different results. But ultimately, that's a question we won't be able to answer for about 10 or 20 more years. In other words, we need about 10 or 20 more years to figure out what's the long-term effects of serving in the Army today versus serving in the Army, say, 15 or 20 years ago.
Alex, I imagine your office is on the front lines of the Army's current recruiting challenge or crisis, as some have called it. Recent news headlines report that last year was the worst year for military recruiting in terms of meeting numerical goals since the start of the all-volunteer force in 1973. I'm wondering if, you know, either at either of your organizations, if there's been analysis on kind of what drives people to join and what might be driving the crisis. I know Alex, you talked about essentially it's increasingly challenging to compete with the private sector when an individual recruit is looking at different opportunities. There's also been reports that there's a low level of eligibility to join the Army. I think less than 25% of the American population even qualifies to join, and that might be driving it. And then, you know, my own kind of personal experience in my own organization was with the end of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, a lot of people had joined essentially to fight there. And so, you know, the peacetime Army just essentially wasn't appealing to them anymore. Is there any kind of data or discussions in the hallways of which of these is actually the biggest driver of the recruiting crisis?
One thing that's driving the current challenge is the economy. The economy is doing well. I mean, we hear about inflation, but like it's also important to keep in mind that the other side of this coin is that unemployment is very low. And so individuals who are looking for jobs, there's a lot of opportunities for them. And historically, the Army has faced recruiting challenges when the economy is doing well, and the recruiting becomes a little bit easier when the economy is not doing poorly. Now, the Army is certainly not advocating for the economy to start doing poorly. That generates all sorts of other problems with funding and other things as well. But it is just a fact of life that we have these recruiting challenges seem to be exacerbated when the economy is doing well. And at least from a worker perspective, ignoring the inflation problems, the economy is doing pretty well at the moment. Maybe that changes in a couple of years. We don't know. But that's one factor, external factor, that's driving this challenge. As far as other reasons that we have this challenge, you know, you mentioned the only 25% of Americans being eligible. I don't want to speak too much on that because it does sort of raise this question about, well, you know, maybe the Army's definitions of eligibility can potentially change. And the Army is taking some efforts to look at, all right, if we have soldiers, new recruits who come in and their test scores aren't good enough, are there ways that we can potentially improve their test scores? If new recruits come in and they're maybe slightly overweight or they're not within certain standards physically, are there things that we can do to work with them to get them to meet those standards? And so that hopefully is increasing the eligibility pools.
I mean, I agree with everything that was just said. I think that it's important to understand that overweight problem, though, that is a main disqualifier of most Americans' future prospects joining the Army. And I think that's a societal issue, right? We're a small fragment of society. And so, you know, you have a small amount of individuals that I would tell you that, you know, being overweight is a huge factor in being ineligible to join the Army. I can give you all the data because I got all data heads up here to kind of, you know, talk about other reasons people or prospects are not as enticed to join the Army. I won't go into a lot of detail, but it's people don't want to leave home. Like, that's a real fear. And then, you know, being treated well is a real fear as well, right? And so what we're focused on is how do we help individuals understand that, hey, the Army is a team. It's a team that, you know, believes in treating people with dignity and respect and taking care of each other, right?
Are the current recruiting challenges novel, or are we just facing normal or at least cyclical difficulties? And a second question, both looking back at history and looking at the landscape today, what steps can the Army take to address the recruiting challenge? What is the Army doing right now to address the recruiting challenge?
It kind of relates to this idea of like where recruits in the years of our study very different from recruits today. If you look at historically, it also relates to what Alex mentioned earlier about you know, the recruiting challenges we were facing about 20 years ago. If you look at where we experienced the most recruiting challenges, I think it was between the years of 2005 and 2008. It was at the height of the war in Iraq. It was not going very well. It was prior to the recession, so we didn't, you know, the Army couldn't benefit from a weaker civilian labor market. And we were having a lot of trouble with recruiting at that time. The Army took a lot of steps during those years that maybe were necessary to meet the recruiting challenge at the time, but maybe also had some longer term unintended consequences. So in particular, in response to the recruiting shortage, the Army permitted more applicants who required moral character waivers to enlist. They also permitted more applicants to enlist with lower AFQT scores and more applicants to enlist who did not have high school degrees. And I mention this because in some other research that I'm doing with Matt Gudgeon and others, we're finding some evidence that the Army's loosened recruiting standards during those years may have actually contributed to the rise in suicide and overall like deaths involving drugs and alcohol among some of the service members from those particular cohorts. So I just say that as a cautionary tale of, you know, there are certain steps we need to take to meet this recruiting challenge. Ideally, it's not sort of lowering our standards.
This is definitely not a recruiting pitch right now. But, you know, it is really interesting to think about how the Army is thinking about how to market itself to the current generation of prospects. And in your position right now at the Army Enterprise Marketing Office, Alex, I'd be really interested to hear how the office views approaching the current generation of prospects and how to effectively communicate them to recruit them to the Army.
You know, we are focused on the intangible things that people don't see when they think about Army service. You know, all inclusive things like, you know, medical care, which is a big deal, right? It's a big deal. We talk about the, you know, the money being given for so people can actually buy houses or any of those things. So I think our focus is working on how can we better articulate this package that a prospect will actually receive from said recruiter or whoever to actually help them really understand what the Army actually provides them. You know, you can look at other companies out there. Yeah, they give you money fast, but do they actually have a holistic health care plan for you and your family, right? And so we are working on ways that we can better tell the Army story and articulate, hey, the Army's more than this base pay that you're going to get from joining the Army. Hey, the Army is more than that one bonus that you got when you signed off. These are the other things that you really don't know about the Army that we actually provide for you and your family to actually look at this thing more holistically, right? You know, you have companies out there that, like I said, they'll give you money fast and it'll look like a lot of money, but you don't have actually the healthcare that comes along with that, right? And so people kind of find out the hard way. But, you know, better capturing the Army story holistically and being able to lay that out for a future prospect is something that we are focused on working on because we recognize that maybe we didn't do such a great job of actually letting people know all of the things that come with this package that, you know, that a person would receive.
Yeah, so that actually leads to two follow-up questions, which really can go to either of you. So first, does the Army find that it's more effective to appeal to these kind of material sensitivities of the recruit population or to a sense of patriotism? And on the other side, Alex, you brought up something really interesting in our pre-call, which is worth teasing out a little bit here. Companies are increasingly providing things like tuition assistance and other benefits that they did not used to, which might pose greater competition for the Army in the hunt for talent. Is that something that that the recruiting command that we are recognizing and feeling like we have to adapt to?
I almost want to jump in and answer this. I won't speak to what recruiting command is thinking or the earlier part of your question about, you know, what appeals more to potential recruits, whether it's patriotism or money. But I do want to emphasize this point that, yes, a huge part of Army pay is way more than the base pay. It's the housing allowance, as well as the basic allowance for subsistence and some of the other direct money transfers that people get. And what's not even included in Army pay and doesn't contribute to earnings, but is still very valuable, are things like the GI Bill or the fact that if you have a family, there's free healthcare for not just the service member, but also all family members, and things like childcare subsidies. It's absolutely true that maybe the GI Bill looks a little less lucrative, so to speak, or a little less important in the face of some private organizations that are offering to pay for advanced degrees or other sort of post-secondary education, or even in the discussions among the current administration about rescinding college debt. That said, the GI Bill is still a very, particularly the post-9/11 GI Bill, it's still a very good value proposition. And I feel pretty confident in saying that the education benefits that the Army offers, more than just the GI Bill, but also things such as tuition assistance, are going to far exceed what you would find in a typical civilian job.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, you know, the point of, you know, the from the sales perspective, I look at the GI Bill as a cherry on top, It's not your only source of money to actually be educated in the Army, right? So I tell soldiers all the time, if you get out and you use your GI Bill for an associate's, you've wasted a lot of money in the Army. I mean, the average soldier gets $4,000 per, you know, whatever the case. And I'm using mine right now. So the GI Bill should be used for things to a degree like, hey, I'm working on my master's degree and I'm using it to get top up at this point. So these are the things that we don't articulate as well as we probably could. And we're getting better at it because sometimes you don't know what you don't know. Now, the first question, I'm trying to remember how you phrase it. So if you can refresh my memory on how you phrase it so I can try to get
out. Yeah. Is it more effective to appeal to potential recruits, you know, through money or through kind of a sense of patriotism?
I think it's a mixture. To be honest with you, I think individuals that join the military, regardless of their socioeconomic status, are looking to do something different and looking to improve themselves in some capacity whenever you look at that, right? Improve the, whether it's their quality of life or personal or professional, it's a stair to do that. So I think it's a little bit of both. I think service members or prospects now to, you know, a degree we're focused on Generation Z, but they are focused on service and community and a sense of being connected to other individuals, being a part of something bigger than themselves. So that's where we are right now. So I don't think it's one or the other. I mean, the money is nice. I didn't get a $50,000 sign up bonus when I signed up in 1996, but that's okay. We're past that, right? I think it's a little bit of both. I don't think it's either. I don't think it's all money. Yes, some people come in the Army for money to pay off college debt or whatever the case. But what we're finding it with the prospect in Generation Z is all of those things, all of those elements that I just said. You know, it's just that they want a sense of connectiveness with community. And that's just what it is. And so I would be wrong to say that was just monetary at this point, because I don't really feel it is. I think it's a lot of both, probably.
I completely agree with that. I think if you offered a potential recruit, if you were talking to a potential recruit and you said, look, there's two jobs that pay $50,000 and one, you're working in a basement somewhere and you're just working for, you know, a company that's building a product. And another one is a job where you have an opportunity to serve a community, to work with a larger team and to work towards a larger sort of community purpose. I think most people are going to choose the second option that serves the larger community first. The flip side of that, though, is whether we call that patriotism, sense of service. If you tell that same person 10 years down the road when they select that job that, okay, now we're going to reduce your earnings to $10,000 a year, that sense of patriotism might not be enough to keep them in that particular job. As a joke, I like to say is, yes, I really like what I do. I love my country. If you paid me $5,000 a year to do this job, I would probably leave. So it has to be both. It has to be monetary compensation. It also has to appeal to these things that economists will call compensating differentials. But I think normal people will say the things that bring you joy in life and the things that make you feel like a part of a larger team and a larger effort.
I do want to caveat. I'm pretty sure, you know, Kyle gave the example of working in the basement, but I'm pretty sure he works in a basement in Lincoln Hall at West Point. So
don't worry, I work in a
windowless basement nonetheless.
I'm free now.
But I'm contributing to a larger effort.
I want to caveat on that real quick. I hate to be the sergeant major at caveats on all the things, but I got a caveat on that real quick. You talked about, you know, it's about, you know, to a degree, it's about the story. Like, these individuals will be able to tell a story that nobody else will be able to even compare to. I'm just going to look at myself. Private Alexander from Lafayette, Louisiana. Fast forward 20 something years later, rebuilding the grid in Puerto Rico. That's what I was really doing. Like, I was out there rebuilding the grid in Puerto Rico, out there flipping COVID barracks and actually, you know, what other organization in the world will put you in situations that not only helps you grow, develop, but gives you situations that you'll be able to talk about for a lifetime that will not compare to working in that basement for $50,000, like that was stated earlier. It's the experience and the extraordinary, you know, things that you'll be able to accomplish That's what the individual, you know, Generation Z, they're looking at. I want to be able to tell this extraordinary story while doing all these things at the same time. And I would say, absolutely, you can do that.
Well, unfortunately, we have run short on time. Command Sergeant Major Faith Alexander and Lieutenant Colonel Kyle Greenberg, thank you for sharing your research and your extensive experience with the Social Science of War podcast. This was a great conversation.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks again for having me.
Thank you for listening to Season 1, Episode 3 of the Social Science of War podcast, brought to you by the Department of Social Sciences at West Point. We release a new episode every 2 weeks. In our next episode, I discuss the lessons that the Army should take from 20 years of fighting in Afghanistan and how that might apply to the future of strategic competition with Ambassador and retired Lieutenant General Douglas Lute and Major Sam Wilkins. After that, I discuss the role of NATO in a potential escalation of land warfare in Europe with Lieutenant Colonel Jordan Becker and Dr. Benedetta Berti, the head of policy planning at the Office of the Secretary General at NATO. If you enjoyed the episode, please consider subscribing, leave a positive rating and comment, and most importantly, please share the Social Science of War with other land warfare and Army professionals. One final note, what you heard in this episode does not represent the views of West Point or any agency of the U.S. government. Thank you again, and we will see you next time.